God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things. This is Brother Hutchings inviting the listeners to another Watchman on the Wall program of Southwest Radio Ministries. And here now is Brother Jerry.
Today is the day Israel celebrates its rebirth as a nation. It was on May 14, 1948 when that happened. So today, and tomorrow, we've invited Dr. Michael Curtis to the program. Dr. Larry Spargimino will be speaking with him about a factual and insightful book Professor Curtis has written entitled Should Israel Exist? With a subtitle of A Sovereign Nation Under Attack by the International Community. Dr. Curtis is a distinguished professor emeritus of political science at Rutgers University. He's highly regarded as an expert in several fields, including political theory, comparative government, European politics, and the Middle East. He's immensely qualified to write on the subject of Israel's existence in 2012. Here now is Dr. Spargimino to begin today's interesting program.
Thank you, Jerry, and greetings to all in our listening audience. We're relating and tying in these programs with the anniversary of Israeli statehood. And I think you'll find a lot of information in these programs, but this is just scratching the surface. Friends, I know that you will want your own copy of Dr. Curtis's book, Should Israel Exist? Dr. Curtis's approach is that Israel's enemies use arguments that lack truth. These arguments are academically and historically erroneous, and he brings so much information that I think you will really have to agree with him, even if you come from another perspective. Dr. Curtis, it's so good to have you with us on our broadcast.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for those kind words. I know you seem to have read the book very thoroughly and perhaps know as much about it as I do.
Well, there's so much that you have digested. I've just kind of, all these dates and things are floating around, but I know you are the expert, and we're going to get a lot of good information from you. But first of all, let me ask, why the title of your book, Should Israel Exist? Is there any question about that?
No, there isn't. As a matter of fact, it was not the original title, but we thought that would help people be interested. The meat of it is really the subtitle. The subtitle, as you just mentioned, is A Sovereign Nation Under Attack by the International Community. And I devote a lot of space in the book, as you know from having read it, to pointing out how the international organizations and perhaps some well-meaning individuals and groups have used law, international law, and other methods, political and diplomatic in character, to undermine the whole fabric of the state of Israel and can condemn it incessantly. So that is really the point of the book, to point out all the inaccuracies and the falsehoods that have been perpetrated and now are customarily used in these international bodies and by writers, journalists, and unfortunately academics too, who are biased against Israel in this regard.
I know there are so many academics who seem to follow an erroneous position, and it seems like, you know, we're pro-Israel. I guess I would consider myself a Christian Zionist, and yet you'll have some PhD who will come up with some fancy arguments that Israel has no right to exist. So I'm really thankful that you are such a scholar. And I must say, you've taught at Rutgers, you've lectured all over the world, so you are highly qualified for the authorship of such a book.
Well, thank you. I have taught in many places, including, as you know from your own heritage, Italian-American, at the University of Bologna, which I enjoy very much, and a very congenial student body there. But it is, to me, very distressing that there is a politically correct view in the universities and elsewhere in much of the media that is biased against Israel. Now, of course, underlying it to some extent, perhaps one might exaggerate it, but it certainly exists. One ought to be forthright about it, the element of anti-Semitism, which runs through the hostility to Jews and now, of course, to the state of Israel. But in addition to that, for those who are well-meaning people, they've swallowed what I call the Palestinian narrative. That is the idea, the assumption that there is no whole truth, but the Palestinian version of events and history is the correct one. And including into it is the idea that Israel is an evil country, that it should never have been created, that it has been unjust to Palestinians, and so on. All of which is incorrect and fallacious. But some academics who are not well-versed in it just accept this. Now, in addition to that, there is, I think, another factor which has become more and more prominent, and that is the Palestinians have, as a result of coaching originally by the old Soviet Union and even Russia today, that they are victims. They are victims of this atrocious enemy, Israel, and the Jewish conspiracy in general. Now, if you look around the world, you know, look around the world today, here is Syria, which is killing its own people in hundreds every day, all the horrors in African countries and that way. And why on earth should Palestinians regard themselves as the only victims in the world? An oppressive regime. Now, there are problems, of course, in the relationship, and it's correct to do it. My point is always that if there are faults or deficiencies in Israeli behavior and conduct and actions, they should be pointed out. No one is perfect. No regime is perfect. No individual is perfect. And there are always problems that arise, and it's appropriate and indeed incumbent in democratic countries for those criticisms to be made. But what is the point here is this total unjust condemnation and the double standards that are being employed and have been adopted in evaluating Israeli behavior, attitudes, and actions, while the violations of codes of honor, the social, legal, by other nations, have been mostly ignored. And very few resolutions of the international bodies have referred to those inefficiencies, say the absence of human rights, or women's rights, or freedom of expression in Arab countries, which still goes on.
Right, and it's very brutal in those countries. And I just love the way you speak of how international law is sometimes used to achieve political or military objectives. And you have a term, I've never heard it before, but I think it's a good one. It's lawfare. Tell us about lawfare, L-A-W-F-A-R-E, and its application to the Israeli state.
Well, I'll tell you what it means. Now, in Istanbul, the head of Hamas, who is in the group that governs Gaza, but who does not live there, and he made a speech in Istanbul, Turkey, and he said, we are carrying on the battle against Israel, not by military means, but by political, press, diplomatic means. And that's essentially what lawfare is. It's the use of the law in order to disrupt Israeli activity and to introduce lawsuits and force Israel to change its attitude in order to deal with these lawsuits everywhere in the world. Now, coupled with this concept of lawfare is what I call universal jurisdiction. Now, that's not difficult to understand. What it means is that since the end of World War II, various international law has been introduced in order to deal in a just way with those who have been offensive in war crimes, crimes against humanity, and so on. It was first really employed in the Nuremberg trials to deal with the Nazi criminals. Now, it's wholly appropriate that this should be done. What the method is that it allows individuals in any country, suppose, say, let's take the United States, to call for a warrant for the arrest of an individual, not American, and not for any crime committed in the United States, a warrant for the arrest for alleged crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and so on. Now, as I say, in principle, one can understand that this would be appropriate. Say, Milosevic in the horrors he committed in the Balkans and so on. But the point is that it's been mostly used against Israelis. And you get a number of cases where warrants have been issued, or attempts to use them, to prevent Israeli officials from visiting London and engaging in conversations with their British counterparts. So it's an abuse, what I call an abuse or a misuse of law for partisan purposes. The crimes have not been committed in the first place. And secondly, they're there to disrupt and to cast aspersions against Israeli officials and the state as a whole. I've just written a piece which is on this issue and refers to this whole incident. It's about the theatrical performances in the famous Globe Theatre, the Shakespeare Theatre in London, which is putting on 37 Shakespeare plays. The Israeli, famous Israeli company, the Habima Company, is coming and putting on The Merchant of Venice. Russia and other countries are putting on, Turkey, their own versions. What has happened is that 37 theatrical performers, actors, writers, and directors, and so on, have objected to the performance of the Habima thing. It's the only group to which objections have been found. And you see, this is a bias, the use of legal methods in order to prevent Israelis performing. You ask yourself, what harm is there? What possible reason is there for a very distinguished theatrical company being banned from performing a Shakespeare play? It's nonsensical.
Well, it's obviously biased against the Jew and the state of Israel, as we see so many times. But let's pause briefly. Friends, we are visiting with Dr. Michael Curtis, and he has written a very well-documented book entitled Should Israel Exist? This is the kind of book that you need on your bookshelf, and because there's so much confusion about this issue. You see it on the news. You hear it from various heads of state. You hear the UN pronouncing all of these draconian resolutions against the Jewish state. So, Brother Jerry, let's pause a bit. Come to the mic and tell our listeners how they can get their own copy of Should Israel Exist?
Yes, but first let me say to our listeners that they not only get the book as a great addition to their library, but to do more than put it on the shelf. The 350-page hardback might look good, but the contents are so important, especially if you support Israel. Dr. Curtis gives information you may not know about. Should Israel Exist is available in appreciation of a $30 contribution if you live in the United States, $33 for our friends in Canada. To get your copy of the hardback, call 1-800-652-1144. Write to Southwest Radio Ministries, P.O. Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma 73008, or visit our website at swrc.com. We'll have more to say about the book at the close of the program, when we'll also repeat information on how to get it. But right now, let's rejoin Dr. Spargimino for the conclusion of today's program.
Michael, today is May the 14th, and of course we know that this is the celebration, the anniversary of Israeli statehood. Tell us a little bit about the circumstances that led up to May the 14th, 1948, and tell us, did this fledgling nation receive a cordial welcome from her neighbors, or was something else the reality of it all?
Well, you asked for a little bit. I can tell you a lot, but of course it would take a great deal of time. The point is that the story goes back a long time, to the beginning of Jewish settlement in the area, which one can call by different names, the Land of Israel, Eretz Israel, or Palestine, or the Holy Land, whatever name you want to give that particular area. In 1922, there was a Balfour, there was a mandate of the League of Nations, which is the predecessor of the United Nations today, which established a mandate, and the mandate was given to Britain to rule. So Britain ruled this area. Now remember, this area was not a Palestine. There was no such thing as Palestine until 1922. It was an area that had been ruled for four centuries by the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire had set up districts in the area, which he called by different names. the whole point and the answer to the Palestinian narrative and claim, there was no such thing as a Palestinian state. There were simply districts. In 1922, Britain, therefore, called it Palestine and ruled over the area. The area east of the Jordan River was hived off from the Mandate, and that was then called the Emirate. It was called Transjordan, that is, across the Jordan, became the Emirate, and then later the Kingdom of Jordan, which it is today, and given to a Hashemite prince who is still the ruler, the ruling family. The rest was under British jurisdiction. Britain had a number of conferences in order to deal with it. The most important for our purposes was in 1937. And that was called the Peel Commission Report, a commission headed by Lord Peel, which for the first time suggested that the land be divided between the Jewish community and the Arab community. You remember at that time, there was no such thing as a Palestinian community. It was all Arab as part of the Arab nation. The Jewish community in the area accepted it. The Arabs did not, and so the struggle went on. In 1947, as a result of the hostilities which were continuing, Britain decided to could no longer rule the area and gave up the mandate. And in November 1947, the United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution which is the most significant single resolution referring to the matter, which called for the partition of the states, the area into two. And curiously enough, you'll be interested, a special jurisdiction for the area of Jerusalem. Jerusalem would be under a kind of international control as a separate entity. The Jewish community, which had a very firm infrastructure, accepted this. The Arab states did not. And there lies the problem, that it was a one-sided, it's always been a one-sided area. The Arabs, whether they were Arab nations as a whole, with or without the Palestinians, have always said no to a compromise solution. As a result of the November 1947 General Assembly resolution, the State of Israel was founded on the night of May the 14th in Tel Aviv. And so the State of Israel came in. The vote was divided. The United States, of course, voted in favor, but it was very difficult to get the appropriate majority, which it was done, and the state came into existence, and the next year was accepted as a member of the United Nations. The Arab countries, the Arab states, were vehemently against, and the day after the State of Israel was declared, five Arab armies invaded the new State of Israel, which therefore had to fight for its very existence. And consequently, the problems that still exist were created at that time with the dispersion of Palestinians from the area and the expansion of Israel into various territories. So that's the basis of the creation of the state in 1948 after agreement. So you've got a double issue here. One, the state was founded with international agreement, and secondly, it was the return of Jews to a state of their own in their ancient homeland, in the Holy Land.
What a significant time that was. I'm just thinking, after centuries and centuries of being occupied by Persians, Greeks, Romans, the Ottoman Turks, then we come to May 14th, 1948. Truly very, very amazing. Now, I do believe that David Ben-Gurion must have had a very, important role in helping the Israelis think in terms of, hey, I'm a sovereign state. I mean, this is a whole new thought for Jews after 2,000 years. You know, they had been occupied by foreign overlords for centuries. What are some of the things that David Ben-Gurion did to just give the Jews once again a sense of this is your land?
One of the things, I think it's attributed to David Ben-Gurion, but it might have been someone else who said it, Jews have had a lot of history and not enough geography. It was the return to the state's import. Now, let's go back a few years. In 1917, during World War I, the Balfour Declaration was issued. That was a declaration by the Foreign Secretary of Britain, speaking on behalf of the British government, that it would be desirable to establish a national home in Palestine. It was Ben-Gurion who translated that national home into a state, that sovereign state, as I say, a sovereign nation, which would be able to govern itself. So Ben-Gurion's argument was that the Jews have had no experience of statehood since the Kingdom of David, almost 3,000 years ago, and therefore it was incumbent upon them to do it. And he established what the Jewish community did from the 1920s on was to establish an infrastructure, that is, an executive and a legislative body under British rule. Again, the Arabs refused to do that. They refused to participate in any legislative body or to take part in any consultations about it. But the Jewish infrastructure, and with a secret army too, was in place. And therefore, when Ben-Gurion took the chair and proclaimed the State of Israel, as he did as chairman of the Jewish Agency at that time, everything was in place. And therefore, the Jews could take over and establish the state. Ben-Gurion was outstanding in this respect, that he wanted to, and did, get rid of all the obstacles in holding state power, because there were other groups, there were other military groups in existence, and other organizations that might challenge the sovereignty of the state. Ben-Gurion ended this, and therefore the state was established with control over the whole territory.
Well, friends, this is so significant, especially this time of the year, loaded with information. As you can see, Dr. Curtis has lectured, has written on this subject. This is a book that you must have. And so as we close, let me get our announcer, Brother Jerry, once more back to the microphone. Brother Jerry, how can our listeners get their own copy of Should Israel Exist?
Thanks, Brother Larry. There are three ways to get the 350-page hardback book: telephone, mail, or the Internet. Our phone number is 1-800-652-1144. If you use the mail, the address to write is Southwest Radio Ministries, Post Office Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma, 73008. The website address is swrc.com. Should Israel Exist is available in appreciation of a $30 contribution in the United States, $33 for those in Canada. Don't miss getting your copy of Should Israel Exist. Today and tomorrow's programs are available on CD for an offering of $14 in the U.S., $15 in Canada. Give us a call at 1-800-652-1144. Write to Southwest Radio, Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma. The zip code is 73008. Or go online. The website address is swrc.com. And remember, Brother Hutchings has designated May as Station Identification Month. So please let us know the call letters or dial position when you call, write, or use the Internet. That is, if you want us to continue on your station. We're evaluating response from all the stations in an effort to make sure we're being good stewards of the funds the Lord provides. Stay tuned for a Bible in the News report over most of these stations. Join Dr. Larry Spargimino and Dr. Michael Curtis tomorrow for the conclusion of the series on your Watchman on the Wall program of Southwest Radio Ministries. Welcome to today's Bible in the News report, a feature of your Watchman on the Wall program of Southwest Radio Ministries. I'm Jerry Giltner. I'll be bringing you today's report. There are a number of reasons that the United States has lasted as long as it has. The free enterprise system has been one of them. The hardworking men and women of America and the companies that employ them have been the backbone of a republic that has lasted longer than any other. Alexander Tyler, a Scottish history professor, said in 1887 that a democracy is always temporary in nature. And we've seen that the average age of the world's greatest civilization since the beginning has been about 200 years. The United States in 2012 is 236 years old. But some in this nation want to take away the right of men and women to work unencumbered by organizations that exist primarily for their own benefit while purporting they are for the worker. We speak, of course, of labor unions. And at this point in history, they are set on requiring workers to pay union dues in order to ply their trades. But news from the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation indicates the courts have put the brakes on one of the latest efforts coming down from the current administration's National Labor Relations Board, NLRB. We quote from an email by the National Right to Work organization on April 19, 2012. Over the last week, two federal courts have issued strong rebukes against the Obama Labor Board's crusade to strong-arm virtually every workplace and worker in America into unions' forced dues ranks. Last year, the Obama National Labor Relations Board, far exceeding its authority, announced a new policy to force its way into private sector workplaces nationwide. This week, in a case brought by National Right to Work Foundation attorneys, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia enjoined the board from enforcing the new rule, which was set to go into effect on April 30th. Meanwhile, a federal court in South Carolina ruled that the NLRB lacked the authority to implement the policy. The injunction will remain in effect until the Court of Appeals issues a final ruling. Close quotes. The Right to Work organization points out that the policy would put mom-and-pop shops, small businesses, larger companies, even some religiously affiliated organizations, under the Obama Labor Board's microscope, even if the employees have no interest in unionization. When unions started, they were probably needed to control some abuses. But over time, they seem to have become an entity unto themselves, with more concern for dues and power than anything else. The Bible has quite a lot to say about laborers, and one of the verses we reference is Proverbs 16:26, where we read, "He that laboreth for himself, for his mouth craveth it of him." Workers benefit the companies for which they labor, and it seems they also should be given full wages for their efforts. That's today's Bible in the News report of Southwest Radio. To get a complimentary copy of the monthly publication, call 800-652-1144. Write to Southwest Radio, Box 100, Bethany, Oklahoma, 73008. Be here for the next Watchman on the Wall program and a Bible in the News report.